with the FDA. Abbott is expected to reopen its Sturgis plant as soon as this weekend, potentially alleviating the worst of this crisis by the end of July. Meanwhile, this corporate formula cartel profiting off babies' bellies while feeding at the public trough must be reined in, constrained by effective regulation and empowered consumers.
Operation Simon.
Part 1.
Operation Simon. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. All the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. In the post-war modern era, both rivals tried very hard to win the competition and defeat their tenacious opponent. It was an all-out rivalry, which wasn't very friendly at all. An arms race, the strengthening of military forces and economies, and many other issues had created a battlefield between the two poles, which later became known as the Cold War. It was a time when the East and West would on the surface shake the hands of friendship, but in secret, point their weapons at each other. The Cold War and all its fearsome features took the US and USSR to the brink of war on a number of occasions. But under the shadows of a scary invention, it never turned into an actual armed conflict. It was the dark clouds of nuclear fission and the devastating shadow of the atomic bomb which kept the flames of the Cold War from flaring up. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. Of course, the USSR had to some extent succeeded, and communism was rapidly spreading around the world. Many big and small countries added the Red Star of Communism to their flag and stood with the Eastern camp. Communist ideology was rapidly spreading to weaker countries, and the formidable rival of the USSR had to do something to solve this problem. The U.S. wasn't idly sitting by either. With Truman's four-point program and Kennedy's Peace Corps, it tried to neutralize the USSR's plans.
This corps will be a pool of trained men sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health.
The fact is, the U.S. wanted to create structural transformation and elevate welfare levels in weaker countries to create a block against the propaganda of the communists. Back then, the U.S. had no bigger goal than combating communism, so it did everything it could to win the hearts of the countries in need and remind them that the country that is truly worried about global welfare is the U.S., not the Soviet Union. But the battle of the Cold War powerhouses, like any other complicated game, had hidden layers which made the battle hotter and hotter. At a time like this, the center of gravity when it comes to global politics and energy, meaning the Middle East, wasn't spared of the game of choosing sides between the East and the West. The region has always been the battleground for global powers. The USSR got to the Middle East sooner than its rival and had won over the hearts of Arab leaders. The Prime Minister of the USSR was an ally of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Egypt's second president. With the help of Abdel Nasser's influence among Arabs in the region, the Soviets wanted to change the color of the map of the Middle East into the red communist star. The Soviets knew that the entrance gate of the Arab world was Egypt and Abdel Nasser. By raising the ideology of pan-Arabism to unite the Arab race, and of course his constant quarrels with its unwanted neighbor, Israel, Nasser had become the hero of Arabs. When Egypt, at the forefront of the Arab world, showed communism the green light, Syria also leaned towards the USSR. Syria had recently united with Egypt and established the United Arab Republic. A short while later, in May 1967, Anwar Sadat, the Speaker of the National Assembly of Egypt, went to Moscow to meet with Soviet Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin. That's where he was told that America's friend, meaning Israel, had gathered a large number of its forces on the Syrian border and the threat of an Israeli attack on the United Arab Republic was serious. The communists were forced to give this mischievous news to Egypt because they thought that military confrontation between the allies of the East and the West in the Middle East would lead to the victory of the Eastern Bloc.
We believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step, that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The Straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The USSR wanted to prove its friendship to Egypt and, of course, not be left behind from its rival, the US, in equipping its allies in the intelligence field. So, it got to work and laid cables on the seabed from the USSR to Egypt. The purpose was to be able to whisper in the ears of the Egyptians anytime it wanted. When the USSR realized that it's too late, and the war will inevitably happen, sooner or later, it ordered its naval forces in the Black Sea to move closer to Egypt's shores. Based on this order, 20 Soviet warships sailed to the east of the Mediterranean and were put on standby position. The USSR didn't want to leave its Arab allies alone in the war against Israel. But on the other front, the US ordered its 6th Fleet based in the Mediterranean to pull back from at least 100 miles from the danger zone. But one of the ships in the 6th Fleet didn't receive the order. As the entire fleet was pulling back, the USS Liberty had received orders to get closer to the Sinai shores. The Liberty was an unarmed naval ship with 45 powerful eavesdropping antennas, tens of advanced data processing and information analysis devices with language experts and professional analysis who were used to listen in on radio communications. The the Liberty was getting closer to the crisis region to listen in on what was happening.
If it was broadcast on a radio wave, we could receive it at any frequency, low frequency, high frequency, medium frequency, very low frequency. If it was out there, we could receive it. If we were listening and we heard a signal, and when we looked at it, we couldn't understand it, it was encrypted as well, we'd send it back to NSA and let them hit it with their computers.
The Liberty's confidential messages were radioed to the NSA, the U.S.'s top secret intelligence agency for the analysis and data processing of electric intelligence. On May 22, 1967, and before the beginning of a new mission in the Mediterranean Sea, the Liberty had slowly and steadily left the Norfolk port in the UK for the Guinea Gulf and the Abidjan port in the western shores of Africa. Its mission in this beautiful port in the country of the Ivory Coast was to listen in and find out whether things were going according to the US's liking or not.
We were sent around the world, wherever there might be a hot spot, to see if we could determine what was going on and if the United States desired any intervention of any sort.
The Liberty was leaving Abidjan port as Israeli forces were in military position and getting ready for action. Of course, the Egyptians were based in the Sinai Desert before them. The Israelis preferred for the issue to resolve without military action, because they weren't ready to fight, and on two different fronts, from the southwest with Egypt and the north and east with Syria and Jordan.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
a
situation of law.
What do you want the United States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
U.S. President Lyndon Johnson asked Israel not to start the war. This is exactly the same thing the USSR told its Arab ally, Egypt, to do. But Egypt had already taken the first step by closing the Straits of Tiran on Israeli ships. Things really got bad when other Arabs joined hands with Abdel Nasser and allied themselves with him in destroying Israel. King Hussein of Jordan was the first to sign a joint defensive alliance with Nasser and put his army under his orders. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia also went to meet with Nasser and pledge him his support. The U.S. wanted to know what secrets about the inevitable war in the Middle East the USSR was whispering in the ears of the Egyptians at any cost. Events were happening as the Liberty was in the Mediterranean and had reached the Rota naval station in Spain, so it could add three experts in Russian and Arabic to its crew. In the Israeli camp, the situation was in crisis mode. Egypt from the west, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north are on standby, awaiting orders from Abdel Nasser to finish Israel off. Levi Eshkol, the Israeli prime minister, thought of a surprise attack as the only way to end the crisis and informed his new defense minister, Moshe Dayan, of his opinion. June 5, 1967, was chosen as the day to attack the Arabs. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Forty-five minutes later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has retained the support of most of his colleagues, but found himself in a much weaker position after 148 Conservative MPs voted to oust him from Downing Street. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson wins no confidence vote despite unexpectedly large rebellion. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson was clinging to his premiership on Monday night, 6th of June, after 148 of his MPs voted to oust him from Downing Street in a ballot that exposed potentially fatal rifts within his party. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, won the support of 211 MPs, but 41% of his party voted to get rid of him, with many citing his lack of repentance over the Partygate scandal and the public's loss of trust in his leadership. It was the worst verdict on a sitting prime minister by their own party in recent times. Although Boris Johnson and his allies claimed the vote as a victory, many Conservative MPs, including some of his supporters, believe the attempted coup is the beginning of the end of his three-year premiership. With so many of his party having voted against him, the Prime Minister has effectively lost his majority support in Parliament, with the risk that his government is paralysed. Johnson is theoretically safe from another leadership challenge for a year under the rules of the 1922 committee. But Theresa May was forced to leave office just 6 months after winning a confidence ballot, having been terminally damaged despite winning by 200 votes to 117. The proportion of MPs who voted against Boris Johnson is even greater than the votes against Theresa May in 2018, and Margaret Thatcher in 1990. Margaret Thatcher resigned just a week later. Speaking after the result, Boris Johnson insisted it was an extremely good, positive, conclusive, decisive result that would allow him to move on to unite and focus on delivery. He also claimed he had won a far greater mandate from colleagues than he did in his 2019 leadership election, although critics cast doubt on that claim. Johnson also declined to rule out calling a snap election, although he said he was not interested in that idea. Nadeem Zahawi claimed Boris Johnson had won handsomely, and he hoped the result would draw a line under the speculation from the media and the Twitterati, leading to a united party. The Education Secretary also claimed that Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, would be punching the air at the result. James Cleverly, the Foreign Office Minister, called it a comfortable and clear win for Boris Johnson, while the MP for Lichfield, Michael Fabricant, said the result was a lot better than he had feared. However, rebel MPs said Johnson should quit for the good of the party and the country. Sir Roger Gale, one of Boris Johnson's leading critics, said a Prime Minister of honour should realise he had lost the support of a sizeable number of his MPs. He suggested rebels would continue to oppose Boris Johnson remaining as Prime Minister. The scale of the rebellion means some government ministers and aides must have voted against Boris Johnson in the secret ballot while remaining publicly supportive. One former cabinet minister said he believed Johnson could soon face other attempts to oust him if the Tories lose in two by-elections on 23rd of June, or the Prime Minister is found by a parliamentary inquiry to have misled the House of Commons. The role of the chief whip will be key, he said. It will be his role to tell the Prime Minister he has lost his cabinet. Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, said the Conservative Party believes the British public now have no right to expect honest politicians, while Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, said Tory MPs have narrowly voted to keep a lawbreaker and a liar in No. 10 Downing Street. The confidence vote was triggered early on Monday morning after more than 54 Tory MPs, 15% of the total, submitted no-confidence letters to Sir Graham Brady, chair of the 1922 committee that represents backbenchers. Boris Johnson had embarked on a last-minute bid to win over colleagues, but a number of Tory MPs said they were surprised by the lack of effort put into the operation. The rebels started the day thinking that Johnson was certain to win the vote convincingly, but became increasingly emboldened after the resignation of John Penrose as No. 10's anti-corruption czar and a critical statement from Jeremy Hunt, a possible leadership contender. Anyone who believes our country is stronger, fairer and more prosperous when led by Conservatives should reflect that the consequence of not changing will be to hand the country to others who do not share those values. Today's decision is change or lose. I will be voting for change, Jeremy Hunt said. Announcing that he would quit, John Penrose called on Boris Johnson to stand down too, accusing the Prime Minister of failing to address the broader and very serious criticisms contained in Sue Gray's report into Downing Street parties. John Penrose said the only fair conclusion to draw from Sue Gray's report was that you have breached a fundamental principle of the ministerial code, a clear resigning matter. Jesse Norman, a former Treasury minister, also published an excoriating letter saying that Boris Johnson had presided over a culture of casual lawbreaking at No. 10 Downing Street in relation to COVID. For Johnson to describe himself as vindicated by last month's Gray report was grotesque, he said, adding that breaching the Northern Ireland Protocol would be foolhardy and almost certainly illegal, while the policy of deporting asylum seekers to Rwanda was ugly. A string of Scottish Tory MPs, including leader Douglas Ross and John Lamont, who resigned as a ministerial aide, also said they voted against Boris Johnson. Some MPs hardened their resolve against the Prime Minister after he gave a defiant speech to the 1922 committee late on Monday afternoon, suggesting he would take the same decision again in relation to holding leaving dues in Number 10 during lockdown. He also blamed the media-driven focus on the leadership of the Conservative Party and tried to turn the debate onto Brexit by claiming a vote against him would lead to a hellish Groundhog Day about rejoining the EU single market. Let us refuse to dance to the tune of the media. Let us refuse to gratify our opponents by turning in on ourselves, he said. Let's show this country that we understand that this is a moment to unite and serve. If we can do that, then believe you me, whatever they may say about me, I will lead you to victory again, and the winners will be the people of this country. After the meeting, a Conservative source briefing in support of the Prime Minister also played down the significance of the Partygate furore that has enraged the public. But one of the first MPs to leave the meeting, arch-Brexiter Steve Baker, took a very different view. He told reporters that it was a very, very sad day, but he felt he had no choice but to vote against the Prime Minister. Steve Baker added, "For me, although this is an incredibly difficult moment, I can't move past the requirement to have, at the very top of the government, a culture of compliance with laws," he said. "I told the Prime Minister that if he broke the law, he'd have to go. He clearly broke the law, he has clearly acquiesced in the law being broken, and so I must keep my word."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Patton-Gill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
Okay, recording.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace. That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu. Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Happy New Year. Thank you, and God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the US. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer you see Reagan saying, "Make America great again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then, and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and the perspective is on the rests in the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without
the
narration.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even, you know, even more pernicious perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, and it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So, Neil, if I could bring you in here, there was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalized with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts. And this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
We were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to
pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their homes instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think it should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know. That's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up and he said, Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs.
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult?
What I have to say this one is, you have to, well, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation for being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image. And the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, there are he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theatre that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he's not. He never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage. You know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor, and that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president, but actually a sort of very average to mediocre actor can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting, and we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War.
There.
By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks. The defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America, against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements, and internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, you learn that he was called a trigger-happy president. Although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. So you've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? Because many critics have drawn many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing Republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance is, which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed. And critics say that actually Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but and we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people, so we need to be quite careful. And that's, you know, that's the old word really for fake news in a sense. But I think it is true. There's been a ramping up of that, and Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level, I think, with Trump and with the Tory government in Britain as well. We've actually got to a point where lying has become, fake news if you like, lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
I'll have to pause you there. We will pick up that more in the next part.
Gorbachev seems to be most confident that he can outperform Ronald Reagan. He's feeling comfortable, he's feeling good about the way things are going, and he thinks that he should be able to strut his stuff as well on the world stage.
It is Gorbachev who is very vocal with the press, talking, right, laughing, smiling. It is Mr. Reagan who is sitting back, speaking monosyllabically. Now, why isn't Mr. Reagan coming forward in the way that we've seen him in the past?
Gorbachev is trying to win through public opinion what he doesn't necessarily get at the negotiating table. If he can gain leverage against the United States through his propaganda efforts, then he can win something at the table.
And so the stage is set for Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev to report on their summit. With every indication, they will call it a success. But behind all the smiles and rhetoric, the question is whether they have really done something to make the world breathe easier.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, can I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is The Reagan Show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or the Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that, I think the other thing we have to be really careful is, this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States, it's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly, and it's also got a very media savvy figurehead who can basically go toe-to-toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part in play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race. But I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
That is a good point. Actually, it does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and was seen as actually not existing, and there was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed a technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent, would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it, you know, it shows that it got ramped up at this moment, and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood movie. You know, the medium becomes the message, basically.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Lawyers for Donald Trump's one-time chief strategist, Steve Bannon, are making a multi-pronged defense to try and save him from being convicted of criminal contempt of Congress after he was referred to the Justice Department for prosecution for failing to comply with a subpoena in the congressional January 6th inquiry. We now present you an article written jointly by Hugo Lowell and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Pelosi and Other Top US Democrats Subpoenaed Over Bannon Contempt Case. Top House Democrats, including the Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the members of the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January Capitol attack, have been subpoenaed to testify in court in connection with the criminal contempt case against Donald Trump's one-time chief strategist, Steve Bannon. According to a source familiar with the matter, the subpoenas, which were accepted by the House counsel, Doug Letter, recently compelled a handover of documents and testimony about internal decision-making that led to Steve Bannon's contempt case. But whether the subpoenas stand depends on how Judge Carl Nichols rules at the hearing in the coming days, where he will assess pretrial motions. Judge Carl Nichols could decide the testimony of members of Congress, for instance, is inadmissible because of protections like the so-called speech and debate clause. Steve Bannon's lawyers are seeking cooperation from the top Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, the House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, all members of the Select Committee, and three Select Committee counsels, as well as Letter. The subpoenas request materials that Steve Bannon's lawyers believe will provide evidence